session number 23216, Reel 11.
Colonel Corbould, Reel 11. Did you go on any historical visits while you were with 10th Para?
Well, I did, on two occasions, 10th Para being an Arnhem battalion. I went twice to Arnhem with the TA commanding officer. We also were accompanied by a man called Colonel Freddie Goff, who in fact had been with the Recce Corps at Arnhem, got a military cross. So it was a most instructive visit, and we walked the course, and it was extremely interesting, and we saw exactly where Colonel Frost had defended the bridge, and heard all sorts of stories of Colonel Frost, which was a legion, which we won't go into now. But it was a very, very interesting visit indeed, and I learned a good deal on the ground about the Battle of Arnhem.
Was this just a small group of officers, or was it on a grander scale?
Yes, it was a small group of officers going, in point of fact, in September 1962 or 3. It was at Arnhem time, the 17th of September, and we went there to lay wreaths and to walk the course, yes. And also, some of the TA people did, in fact, do a drop on a Ginkle Heath. Ginkle Heath.
Did you go south of the river, down onto the area towards
Nijmegen? We concentrated completely on Arnhem itself, and particularly the bridge. And we saw exactly what the problem was.
What about the Oosterbeek perimeter? Did you have a look around that?
Yes, which of course had been restored by that time. There's a most wonderful museum there too, run by the Dutch. And because the Dutch, if you wear a parachute regiment tie anywhere in that area, you're totally at home, which is wonderful. The most wonderful people, and they're very hospitable indeed. Mm. And we had to be very careful about their hospitality too, I might say.
It can be overwhelming.
Very overwhelming indeed, yes. Mm. Particularly when the schnapps appears, and very little eats. Anyway, that's another matter, but we kept ourselves under control. Mm-hmm.
The military life has many perils.
Many perils. Mm-hmm.
And did you go back, or was this your only visit to Arnhem?
We did it twice. No, I haven't been back since, no.
On the same format?
On the same format, yes. Mm. Well, in Edinburgh, I did, I suppose, three times. So I had to do a recce, first of all, to see exactly what the lay of the land, then muster the people, and then take them out twice. So it was a very interesting visit, three very interesting visits indeed.
Was it intended to be instructional, or was it primarily commemorative?
Both. As a professional soldier, and not having been in the Northwest European campaign, I was very interested in any part of it, but particularly as a parachutist, I was very interested in that particular the battle.
One thing that is rather intriguing is the reason, which has never really emerged, why the airborne forces at Arnhem gave up the high ground over the ferry at Driel, which is just a little way along from the Oosterbeek perimeter area and the Hartenstein Hotel.
Well, I'm not really in a position to talk about that at all. We didn't study that particular aspect, but of course the whole thing really stemmed from the fact that they were dropped in the wrong place to start off with. All their problems stemmed from that. And the second one, that the Germans were there en masse.
They were, yes.
And the intelligence, of course, was very bad indeed.
Did you go through the Wolfhazer area?
Where
the Recce ran into the German armoured car detachment.
No. It was really two para which we were mainly interested.
Ah, so that's the...
It was the bridge.
Yes, the route down along the edge of the river.
The edge of the river, yes. Leading up to the bridge itself, yes.
When you were regimental adjutant, you were saying that one of the things that was of interest to you was selecting officers for the regiment. What were you looking for in potential officers for the parachute regiment? What qualities were particularly important?
Well, I think first and foremost, of course, the fitness side, and secondly, their intelligence. I mean, the last thing we wanted was the tough paratrooper officer. That was the image of a chap we did not want in any shape or form at all. And so some of these people joined with that idea in mind, the bully, no hope at all. We wanted the chap who was deep thinking, who was thoroughly fit, and who could absorb the airborne spirit of comradeship and getting on with other people terribly well. And we found this a good deal. This led, perhaps this is the place to mention the fact that I went to Bahrain. I went to Bahrain with the commanding officer of the 1st Battalion, now General Retired John Graham, and a great personal friend of mine, and to sort out various officer problems there. And while in Bahrain, when I was there for about, I suppose, 10 days, I went over to Sharjah to visit the Trujillo Oman Scouts, because we'll be having officers on secondment over there. And so therefore, I killed, as it were, two birds with one stone, officer-wise. And also, as far as one parish was concerned, the establishment of the battalion, making quite certain that they were getting reinforcements while they were there. We took over from two parish.
What were these problems with officers that you were having?
It's very difficult to tell you this, actually, Nigel, but some officers perhaps didn't quite take to that neck of the woods at all.
They didn't like being in the Gulf.
Well, they tend to get a bit bored. They were looking a bit of action, because they very nearly got in Kuwait, but then at that particular time, the Kuwait thing blew over. But no, I don't want to give the impression that the officers were going bold or anything like that. But I think they were perhaps disappointed in not going to another battalion, which was probably on standby for any operations elsewhere.
What were the training and other facilities like in Bahrain?
There was a massive desert there and so on. It's all very, very flat, mainly shooting. The battalion did an enormous amount of firearms work there, which was absolutely, the terrain was made for it. And that standard of shooting became very high indeed. Also, there were people who had to go down to Aden. There were some detachments went on like that from the battalion. And then, of course, it was a question of, the officers again, and discussing the details of all the officers and what they did and who they were and so on, who were being selected to go down with the company down to Aden to be on secondment to another battalion.
Did you find that most of the officers that you were taking into the regiment were from infantry, or did you take them from across the board within the army?
98% were from infantry. Mm. And, of course, don't forget this, in 1958, we were able to take officers direct from Sister Sandhurst.
What did you prefer? Was it preferable to have young men directly from the training establishment? Or was it better to have them when they'd been broken into infantry work a bit?
Well, we'd like to have them. We were very pleased to get them actually from straight from Sister Sandhurst, and bring them up straight into the regiment and mould them accordingly. Mm. One of our first officers was John Ridgway, who rode the Atlantic with Shea Blythe. Mm. And that was the sort of cat of a chap we were getting in at that time. Oddly enough, the very first man who we had from Sandhurst was an excellent officer, the same calibre as Ridgway, but he got killed in this extraordinary parachuting accident just after he joined. Either he landed in some telegraph wires and tipped upside down, the wires gave away, and he landed on his head and killed himself.
Sounds like very bad luck indeed.
Very, very bad luck indeed. And he was a very promising young officer indeed. Mm. And that was the very first chap that came out from here. Very bad luck.
Now, one of the things that's said about parachute regiment soldiers is that you really do have to keep them busy and give them a variety of things to do.
Oh, yes, you do.
Because otherwise they start getting into trouble because they've got too much initiative and so
yes,
on.
Yes, that's right.
What was that part of the problem in Bahrain, that there weren't enough different things?
John Graham was an outstanding commanding officer. He made quite certain there was plenty going on. A lot of adventure training was going on. Ah. And the company commanders were worked night and day by John to make quite certain that the men were completely under control. Mm. And in the end, they thoroughly enjoyed themselves there. And oddly enough, if there were any, sometimes we had married for families there. Mm. And in the Gulf, the increase in families was quite enormous.
What was going on in Aden? You mentioned that there were detachments going to
Aden. Well, if you remember, there was a sort of, later on, Aden was always on the boil a bit. Mm. And it was just getting onto the boil, because eventually came to a big showdown there, as you know. Mm. Well, this was the prelude to it. Mm.
And what about the business in Kuwait? What was happening there?
Well, I can't remember the exact details, but we were all forming up at one stage for a complete sort of airborne operation in Kuwait. Whether it was unrest there, and of course the oil was very much very attractive indeed, but there was certainly and I know when I was with 38 Group, the contingency planning, we had a plan worked out for Kuwait, but it didn't affect that time count to anything at all.
But I think in 1961 there was a deployment, wasn't there, which was a pre.
Oh, yes, there was, yes.
And deterrent deployment.
Yes,
worked.
Yes, it worked, yes. Mm. Yes.
And the Trouche Le Mans Scouts, did you get into Oman while you were on this visit?
No, I went to Sharjah, to their regimental quarters, and discussed things with the commandant, whose name I keep on forgetting, a very well-known officer. But anyway, it doesn't matter.
What were they doing, the people attached to the Trouche Le Mans Scouts? Was it all a matter of training, or were they on anything?
Oh, I think there's quite a lot of operational work going on there in the Oman at that time. And again, of course, that developed, as you well know. And John Graham, as a brigadier, was in charge of the Omani forces during that particular war.
So this is the business in Doha, then, beginning.
That's right. Yes, and of course the SES were there too, under Brigadier Tony Dean Drummond.
Did you see anything of them while you were?
No, not at all. Never saw them at all. No.
What was there in the headquarters at Sharjah? What?
Well, it was like an ordinary regimental quarters, and it was the whole of the TOS sprung from there. It was like an ordinary regimental quarters.
And who were the scouts? Were they locals recruited into the regiment?
Yes, yes, except the officers. They were all ones, the conduit of other regiments.
And were there any recruits from outside Oman?
That I don't know. That I don't know at all. I mean, I wasn't really concerned with the other rank recruiting at that time at all. Anyway, it was a very interesting visit indeed, and broadened one's view too.
Did you do any other visits while you were a regimental adjutant?
The only other thing I had to do was to go to Amsterdam with the mass bands for a flag showing performance in Holland, which was quite amusing. We were there for about a fortnight, and it was sort of a tattoo, and each stadium where we did this, it was absolutely packed every night. But we couldn't go wrong, you see. Parish Red Berries,
indeed.
Again in Holland, and in Amsterdam, it was very good indeed. And we started off with the ambassador level and worked down the list.
Who was arranging this? Was this the Dutch army?
The Dutch invited the parish regiment to go, and it was thought that the regiment agent was the appropriate man to send in charge of the bands. We didn't have anyone else other than our bands then. But I noticed in other regiments, it was always the regiment legend that gets clobbered with going anywhere when its band's required.
Terrible hardship, I'm sure.
Oh, terrible hardship. Terrible. You'd be surprised how very, some of these directors of music, you know, they get very sort of like prima donnas. And you've got to be very careful with them indeed.
It is the artistic temperament, isn't it?
I'm afraid so, yes. Anyway, they did exactly as they were told, I can assure you.
Where did you get your musicians from? Did you recruit them from
Nella Hall.
Civil life?
Yes.
They came in through Nella Hall.
Yes, and they were trained in Nella Hall, yes. But they came in from the civilian life, yes.
Did they all have to do the same kind of fitness and jump training as the soldiers in the regiment?
No. A lot of them did, volunteered for it, but some didn't. And we only had, I think, as far as our directors of music was concerned, I think we only had about three who became qualified parachutists. So it was very much they could and they couldn't if they wanted to. The majority of the NCOs did become parachutists. But the odd chaps were playing a trombone or beating a drum or clanging a cymbal. Perhaps didn't volunteer.
Did they have a mobilisation role?
Yeah, yes, rather. The normal one, medical people. Yes. They were medics in time of war, yes, and were trained as such.
What were you doing then day to day as regimental adjutant? Was it concerned with things as postings and appointments, that sort of?
Yes, and keeping very close touch with the Ministry of Defence, or the War Office as we called them those days. I mean, it was anything that came through regimentally came onto my plate, and I had a regimental colonel above me. It was a very close-knit team indeed. We had two retired officers working in the headquarters as well. It was plenty of work to do, I can assure you.
Which branch of the Ministry of Defence were you most concerned with then? Would that be the military secretary?
The military and AG2O, as it was then called. I have no idea what it's called now at all. Something to do with personnel, I imagine.
Probably something like that.
With 100 letters after its name.
Did you have any difficulty recruiting officers or soldiers at that stage?
No problem at all. I mean, I go back to the days which I've already spoken to you about with the recruit company. I used to get about an average of about 15 to 20 chaps every day.
Yes.
And of course, we selected from there. No, there was no shortage of volunteers from the officers or the other ranks.
Mm. Now, it's often said that within, even within a regiment, every battalion has its own particular character, which it is sustained because it's passed down, you know, from the established members of the unit to those coming into it. Did you find that that was the case in the parachute regiment, that the 1st, 2nd and 3rd battalions all had a distinctive character?
Yes, and it really stemmed from the wartime days. Oh. And, of course, in those days, the wartime commanding officers were still available. Mm. People like Colonel Alistair Pearson and Brigadier James Hill, who is still alive to this day now, age 91. Mm. And, yes, that spirit prevailed very much so. And, of course, in two parachutes, always on him. Very much so.
So how did they compare? What were the distinctive features of the battalions in their temperament and
Well, as people were posted between the lot of them, it was exactly the same. Ah. I saw no difference between 1, 2, or 3 para, quite frankly. I mean, the spirit was still there. Mm. The indomitable spirit to win, to conquer, to do what you ever had to do, to the best of your ability.
And was there a lot of cross-posting between
Not
the
much,
battalions?
Not much, but inevitably, particularly after you got a permanent cadre of officers, it came quite a lot, yes. But you see, before that, we had our commanding officers came from outside. Mm. And very good they were, too. Well, the majority, one or two, were not quite so good.
Well, I mean, of course, it's always controversial when someone from outside a regiment is posted in to take command of it.
Yes.
This does happen.
Yes.
Time to time.
But if a new commanding officer came in from outside, he was very soon told by the regimental colonel and the colonel commandant. In those days, we had a colonel commandant, and we had such people as General Richard Gale, General Ken Darling, and so on. Mm. And it all starts up at the top, and it permeated down. Oh, yes.
Were you working regular office hours then when you were doing this?
No, never did that at all.
Never.
I mean, I used to work, I suppose, on an average from 8 in the morning till, if need be, 8 in the evening. I mean, I never timed that sort of thing. It's throughout my service. I never timed that at all. Mm. If a job had to be done, it had to be done. If I did it quickly, okay, fine. Not quickly, but I spent a lot of time on it. I never timed myself to any timings at all. Mm. I cannot bear the thought of a trade union.
Where were you based? Was this based in Aldershot?
In Aldershot, in Maida House. It's on Maida Barracks in Aldershot, yes. Maida House, which used to be the commanding officer's house of the battalion, which was stationed there.
Did you have staff to help you in?
Yes, we had two civilian clerks and an orderly sergeant, and very good they were too. And again, the team spirit permeated even into those people as well. Mind you, the orderly sergeant, of course, was a qualified parachutist.
How long were you there in that?
2 years.
2 years. What happened to you after that?
Then I went to Australia.
Oh. What were you doing out there?
I was on the British Defence Liaison staff. Mm. Have I not mentioned this before?
Only very briefly.
Yes. Mm. And I was the called the Assistant Military Advisor. Mm. And I'd only been there a short time before the military advisor, a very nice man called Peter Hayter, in the Light Infantry, died. And so, I'm very glad indeed, the military secretary of party will call, will get on with it himself. Mm. So I was given the rank, I was given the pay of a full colonel, which I didn't object to at all, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And after about 4 or 5 months, they sent out another chap, who, of course, I had to teach. That was very good indeed.
But was he your deputy, or was he?
No, he was a full colonel.
Oh, he took over from
him. Yes.
Shame.
But I was always one up there because it was rather good.
What were your main functions as a?
Rarely going into we started off by working in the Australian Army headquarters. Mm-hmm. We had rooms there. And then we moved out then to our own particular rooms elsewhere in Canberra. But I used to go to visit Army headquarters every day. And mainly, well, I went to all arms, because my job was to advise the High Commissioner, who was called Sir Charles Johnson, what was going on Australian Army-wise. And there was a lot going on. The Vietnam War was at its height. And then, you see, they had the most appalling illness cropped up with the Australian Field Force. And one day we had our chief of the General Staff, General, who became Field Marshal Baker, came out. And in the middle of dinner one night, I was sent for to get on the telephone. And this was the chief of the General Staff of the Australian Army, General Daly, who I knew very well, saying, we're in deep trouble. We've got to have someone who, from the British Army, who is an expert in tropical medicine. And we want him with the field force now. So I said, well, I tell you exactly who we've got. There's a man called, I can't think his name, he's a brigadier in Melbourne. And he is an ace expert in tropical medicine. May we please have him? So I said, well, you've struck lucky, because I'm having dinner with the chief of the general staff this minute now.
How did it happen that this brigadier happened to be in Melbourne? Was it just a matter of luck?
We had all sorts of British officers attached out in Australia at that time. And I think it was just a matter of luck, really, that he was a tropical medicine man. I mean, I don't think he was sent there because he was a tropical medicine man. He was just, they wanted a liaison officer with the Australian Medical Corps from the RAMC. And this chap was sent. And so I was told then, I got onto the Minister of Defence in London, or War Office in London, and said what the form was, oh, you can't send him at all. I said, well, this is of the utmost importance. And I have here the Chief of the General Staff, our own Chief of the General Staff, to whom I've spoken, and he said that he is to go. Well, he can only go for a week. I said, okay, fine. I'll get him there. That was the great thing. In fact, he was there for 3 months.
Once he was there, he didn't come back.
What? He wanted to be there, of course. I just said to him, he didn't come back. Mm. There was a certain rule then that no one could go to Vietnam unless they were of general rank.
There was a very strong political feeling against any sort of military involvement by the British Army in Vietnam, wasn't there?
Yes. Yeah. It was purely political. Mm. We've done us a power of good to have had experience in that part of the world.
What did Field Marshal Baker have to say about that then? Because he must have been aware of the...
Well, no, I mean, he knew. Yeah, but this, the request for this specialised officer to go, he said he must go. Mm. And that's my authority. Mm. So I got onto this duty officer. This time it was about midnight in London. I don't know what it was. Anyway, I was speaking to some duty officer. I said, you better get your skates on. Get this man going. I'm going to get him moved tomorrow. And there's no doubt at all. Whatever you say, he's going tomorrow. Agreement was reached.
What sort of things were you discussing with the Australians day to day when you know, you weren't dealing with sudden contingencies? Like
the whole thing was permeated by Vietnam.
Yes.
There was a briefing on Vietnam practically every day. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, I would go and visit the battalions of the Royal Australian Regiment who were going to Vietnam, and I would attend their battalion briefings. And on one occasion, I said to the commanding officer, a delightful man who became a friend of mine called Joel Langtry, I said, can I come with your battalion? He said, of course you can. Mm. So he said, you ought to come as a private soldier, it wouldn't be a problem at all. So I arranged all this and went to tell my high commissioner what the form was. He said, well, I've got news for you. He said, you're not gay.
Perhaps it might have been better not to tell the high commissioner until you'd come back.
Well, where was Corbould? Mm. That's what the form was then.
Well, Corbould is on a visit to a unit somewhere, sir.
With whose authority? With whose authority?
Well, his own authority.
Well, this is when I was on my own, too.
Yes.
No, but I did have a two-star man over me.
You did?
Yes. Mm. A delightful man called Air Vice Marshal Philpott to start off with. And then we had General Ian Gill of the 4th 7th Dragoon Guards, who in fact had been a college commander here way back.
Mm. Didn't, what sort of training did the Australian battalions do before they went out to Vietnam? Were you able to observe that?
To a certain extent, it was very thorough training. They had a very good jungle fighting school, a place called Canungra, up in Queensland, which I went fairly often. Yes, they had very strict training indeed, and very good training. Mm. They were a mighty good field force. Mm.
Did you have opportunities to visit them after they'd come back?
Yes, mm. I did, yes. Mm. And they were very, very critical of the, in an adverse way, of the Americans. Loathed working with Americans. Mm. Here's an example. I was given one day at a debriefing when the battalion came back. It was night, and the Australians were opposite, where there was a large lot of Viet Cong who were in woods. And they were making their plans to do a night attack on this wood. The Americans appeared in another wood near the Australians, making a most terrible noise. They then flew in helicopters with all their food and all that sort of thing, and they had a sing-song. And with the result, of course, when dawn came, the Australians were not able to put in the attack because of what had been going on with the Americans, and they didn't know the Australians were there. But, of course, they did know where the Americans were. Mm. and there were a lot of casualties. A lot of casualties. They were all absolutely napping. Absolutely napping. And that was one example of why they didn't like operating with the Americans.
Were there other examples that you heard all of?
That was the worst one that I heard, I think, yes. I think the Australians thought that the Americans hadn't thought the whole problem through properly, whereas the Australians had thought it through. Very professional soldiers, the Australians. But that's what they really thought. The Americans hadn't really thought, whatever the problem was, hadn't thought it through. The field commanders hadn't.
Did they think that we should be taking part in the war in Vietnam?
Because they were very concerned about their own safety, really, in case the thing escalated and came further to the east, or southeast, rather. They were very keen on their own home defence, the Australians, very keen indeed. And they were, of course, in the Second World War as well, as you know.
How did the Australian Army compare in its organisation and ways of doing things to the British Army? Was it similar, or were there
very similar
differences of any significance?
Very similar indeed. In fact, General Tom Daly, the Australian CGS, very kindly offered me a transfer to the Australian Army. Now, I didn't accept because I wasn't prepared to sell my sword, but I would have had no trouble at all fitting into the Australian scheme of things at all.
Do you know what sort of appointment they were thinking of when they were offering you?
I think they were thinking of transferring me, giving me a battalion. That's what I think. I didn't. This was often mentioned, but the indication was that, which was very kind of them indeed.
Were you tempted at all?
No,
you weren't.
No, I wasn't, because I loved the British Army, and I served under a wonderful man called many years before, called General Ken Darling, when he was a colonel, and he said to me one day, I was just thinking perhaps I might transfer to the New Zealand Army, and he said to me, never sell your sword, and I never forgot it. So I don't have any regrets about that, but I was very proud to be offered that appointment.
What sort of things came up then when you went on your daily visits to the Australian Army headquarters? What sort of business did you have to discuss with them?
Well, first of all, I must tell you who I made friends with. When I arrived there, I took over from a chap who should be nameless, because he's a friend of mine, but the Australians didn't take to him at all. So I had rather the cold shoulder when I first arrived.
Why hadn't they taken to him?
Because he didn't mix in with them at all. And rather, in fact, he said to me, you must treat these people as colonials. And so I made no comment about that.
Tactless.
I'm not mentioning his name, because he's still a good friend of mine. Not in my regiment, I hasten to add. And so it was very difficult to start off with. So I found a most excellent man who was a retired officer.
Aspects of this work, because you were really part of a diplomatic staff.
Oh, yes. Anyway, we had DC on our car, yes. And we had to have a British car, incidentally, too. Yes, and this is my late wife and I, and she was a very good mixer indeed. And she related to all the various other embassies around about in Canberra.
How long did it take you to get on good terms with the Australians and overcome the initial foi d'oeuvre?
I'm proud to say no more than 3 weeks. I'm proud to say that, and I don't mind if it sounds like I'm blowing my own trumpet, but Edna and I worked like slaves at it immediately, had them all round, and did everything we possibly could. And they saw. They're very, very, very perceptive people indeed. And furthermore,